This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Last week, baseball lost one of its most memorable players.
He can do everything, Gibson. Above all, he can throw that ball mighty hard and win.
That's broadcaster Harry Carey describing Bob Gibson, who dominated hitters for the St. Louis Cardinals in the 1960s and 70s with a blazing fastball and an intimidating glare. He died last Friday at the age of 84 from pancreatic cancer. Gibson played in a different era, when pitchers routinely threw complete games, and pitching inside, even knocking batters down, was just part of the game. He played all 17 seasons of his career in St. Louis and accomplished remarkable things. He was an 8-time All-Star, Most Valuable Player of the World Series twice, and he still holds the record for the most strikeouts in a World Series game, 17, against the Detroit Tigers in 1968. He also hit 26 lifetime home runs, 2 in the World Series. Gibson wasn't friendly to opposing players or the media, but the way he saw it, his job was winning games, not making friends. We're going to listen to parts of 2 Fresh Air interviews with Gibson. In one, he sat down with Hall of Fame outfielder Reggie Jackson in 2009 to talk about the confrontation between hitters and pitchers. But first, we'll hear part of his conversation with Terry Gross, recorded in 1994 when he'd published a memoir, Stranger to the Game. Terry asked him why he didn't like letting his catchers call the pitches he would throw.
I felt if you throw a pitch that you don't want to pitch, you're not going to have your heart in it and it's not going to be good. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you when that happened. I remember back when I was very, very young, and you do have to pay attention to what other people think about the league and the hitters when you don't know them yourself. Carl Sawatsky was a catcher for the Cardinals, and he and I had a disagreement about what pitch to throw to a hitter. And I was young and he was experienced, and I would shake him off, and he finally called timeout, and he came out to the mound to tell me that he wanted me to throw a certain pitch. Well, when he went back, got down, and I threw that pitch, guy hit a home run. And from that point on, I said, I'll never do it again. Now, that's not to say that you don't take orders or you don't follow what the catcher wants you to do, but if you don't want to do it, then I say don't do it.
Now, Tim McCarver was your catcher for many years. How did he feel about that?
Well, he felt the same way. You never throw a pitch that you don't want to throw. And usually a catcher like McCarver had his head in the game so much, and he was so smart about what he was doing back there, that I didn't shake him off that often anyway. When I did shake, it was usually to confuse the hitter.
You used to use the brushback pitch. Now, were there times when you intentionally tried to hit a batter?
Oh, sure. And usually that was retaliation. We had a couple of guys, Lou Brock, Curt Flood, and Julian Javier. They got hit constantly. They were very fast. They get on the bases, and they just drove you guys nuts. So they did get hit. And whenever one of my guys got hit when I was pitching, I would just return the favor.
Now, you hit Duke Snyder once and broke his elbow?
Oh, he hit himself.
He hit himself?
Yeah.
Why don't you explain that?
Well, Duke Snyder was a pull hitter, dead pull hitter, and he liked the ball inside. He's a left-hand hitter, and they first moved out to the Coliseum. And the Coliseum's right field fence was a long way away, but the left field fence was only 250 feet away, and Duke Snyder did not hit the ball to left field. First time I faced him, he hit a home run over that little fence out there, which was fine. You know, okay, I'm going to have to start pitching him a little differently. I pitched him away a little farther, about 3 or 4 inches outside, and he reached out and hit the ball. It would have been a home run, but it went foul, and that was the second time up. Well, the next pitch I threw him was inside. Here we go with this pitch that I'm telling you. It keeps the guy from leaning out. Well, he went back out there thinking that the ball was going to be outside, and it hit him in the elbow, broke his elbow.
How did you feel when that happened?
Oh, it was his fault. It wasn't mine. And in fact, I went over to talk to him after the game, and he told me, he says, I was leaning out there, and I shouldn't have been doing it.
Hmm. Did you ever get hit while you were at bat?
Sure. I got hit a lot.
Was that retribution against your pitching?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was the way the game was played.
Boy, so every time you intentionally hit a batter, did you figure, well, that means I'm going to get hit when I'm at
Well, we're making it sound like...
Like it happened a lot of times, which it didn't.
Yeah, and it didn't happen that often. See, you got a guy back there called umpire, and he usually stops all of this.
Right.
When somebody gets hit on my team, and I go back out there and I hit somebody on that team, the umpire will call timeout. He says, okay, guys, that's enough. And usually that is enough, and it stops.
Right.
So you don't spend all game throwing at each other.
Mm-hmm, right. Just tell me more about what your strategy was like when you were on the mound.
All right. We would go into a town, for instance, going into Philadelphia, and we have a three-game series. The first game of each series, we have a report from the scouts, and we would go over each individual hitter. We knew exactly how to pitch them, how to play defense against them. And so what you would do, you would go over it and refresh your memory on what to do. So that's not to say that you would pitch like that all the time. But if you got into a situation where this guy could beat you with a base hit or a home run or what have you, then you went to your strategy. You went to those scouting reports. And pretty much if you stayed there, you'd get the guy out. But if you were continually pitching a guy according to that, he was going to – most of those hitters are good enough to adjust to that. So you try not to pitch them like that all the time.
I think you were the first black athlete to get a scholarship to the college that you went to.
Creighton University.
Did you get a scholarship in basketball and baseball?
No. It was a basketball scholarship, and I just happened to play baseball during the summer, yeah.
So did you think that you would go into basketball at that time?
I thought I was going to be a basketball player, more so than a baseball player. But when I got to be a senior, I thought that maybe, and it didn't seem like anybody was interested that much in me from the professional ranks, I thought maybe I would probably end up in baseball.
You actually played with the Globetrotters for a while, and oh, was it around 57?
Yeah, 1957.
And you roomed with Meadowlark Lemon.
Yes, I did.
But you say you hated the clowning, which is what the Globetrotters were most famous for.
Yes, but I didn't know that at the time because the Globetrotters came into Omaha, and in 1957 and I guess a year or two before that, they had a series with the College All-Stars where they played real basketball. And so I played with the College All-Stars, and I didn't really get to play until the last quarter. I scored a lot of points, and we ended up beating the Globetrotters. Well, they asked me to go with them after that. And so that following fall, I went into Chicago, worked out, made the team. And when we started playing, we started doing the clowning thing. And I didn't realize at first that's what it was. So I didn't really care for that, no.
Why not?
I'm not a clown.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to learn the stunts that the Globetrotters did?
No, it's not hard at all. It's really funny. When you're young, You spin the ball on your finger and you do some of those things. I don't know why you do it, but when it came time to play, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to play basketball.
You said before that breaking records didn't really mean much to you at the time. What did it mean to you to get voted into the Hall of Fame in 1980?
81.
81, okay.
Yeah, going into the Hall of Fame is something that nobody really thinks about while they're playing. And after you finish your career, whatever it is, and you sit down and you think about it, the best thing that could possibly ever happen to you after you get through playing is to go into the Hall of Fame. And when I was inducted, first of all, I thought I would never be inducted because I didn't, you know, the guys that vote on you were reporters, and I didn't talk with reporters a lot, especially on the day that I pitched. I tried to stay away because they would distract you. So I never thought I was going to go into the Hall of Fame. And in fact, I was prepared not to be selected. They called me and told me that they were going to have the voting, and, you know, there was a good chance that I would go in there. So I pretty much resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't going to go in because I didn't think the reporters liked me. But after I went in, after they had the election and I went in, I don't think there's any other feeling greater than that, knowing that they thought, and by they I mean the press and the people that watched you play, thought you were one of the best players ever. It was a great feeling.
Bob Gibson speaking with Terry Gross in 1994 when Gibson had published his autobiography, Stranger to the Game.